Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. Well, America's a melting pot. That's obvious. And today that process has been greatly accelerated for, decades, I guess, by tremendous mobility by the interstates and, by education and people moving around and, and families growing and moving around to find jobs and so on. But obviously, immigration has become a hot political hot potato lately. And largely illegal immigration, but also, after 9/11, immigration in general got tightened up. And so, people with PhDs in engineering and computer science and things that we need aren't allowed into the country like they used to be. So we're still a melting pot, but maybe not melting as fast in terms of the ingredients being poured into the pot as we used to be. But it used to be, though, a slower process over time that groups would come in from different countries and they would stay isolated a lot of times for a generation or more. I mean, think of Little Italy and Chinatown and places like, Irish and Jewish parts of cities, and then whole states like, Minnesota and places like that that are largely German or largely Scandinavian, So that kind of thing used to be a fact of life in America. But over time, the melting pot kind of merged those areas and those boundaries, and they eventually blended in. But there were always groups that were marginalized for various reasons who didn't fit the standard categories. And sometimes that was of their own choosing, and often it was due to social isolation from the people around them. One such group was called the Melungeons of Appalachia, and people who live in northeast Tennessee and southwest Virginia and eastern Kentucky know who they are, who the Melungeons are, but I think it's not that well known a group outside that area. But lately, there's been some news that brought it into the national news about the Melungeons. So we did a show on the Melungeons some time back, and scientific studies have recently been completed that we're going to be talking about today. We're here in the studio today with Wayne Winkler, who is the director of WETS, a radio station, the home station of American Variety Radio, and he's also an historian. And he discovered as a boy that he's descended from Melungeons. He wrote a book about them a while back called Walking Toward the Sunset, The Melungeons of Appalachia. Wayne is also a past president of the Melungeon Heritage Association, and we're going to talk with him about what we know and still don't know about the Melungeons. Welcome, Wayne.
Thank you for having me.
So I mentioned just briefly where they lived, but wanted to describe, it was a very defined area originally where the Melungeon people lived. Where was that?
They were first documented around the beginning of the 1800s in the Clinch River region. The Clinch River runs from southwest Virginia into northeastern Tennessee. And in that area, around 1800, Melungeons first became noticed. The legend was that they had been there all the time, but records have shown that they migrated pretty much with the European-American settlers in the same time frame. So they were immigrants to the area just like everyone else, and they've pretty much been associated with that area since that time, and many of the people who live in that area do have Melungeon ancestry, but Melungeons have migrated just like people from Appalachia in general migrated, as in my father's case, moving up to Michigan to work in the auto plants, and they become pretty much indistinguishable from their neighbors, except for, in many cases, a bit darker complexion, some features that don't seem Scots-Irish like their neighbors.
Well, I think I read in your book and I've read elsewhere that there were about 40 families that were the original Melungeon contingent. And so I don't know if that number is, plus or minus a few or whatever, but it's still a fairly small group. What were some of the family names that are associated primarily and mainly with the Melungeon?
Well, originally there were just a few family names associated with the group, and they were names that are not unusual, basically, English type names like Collins, Gibson, Bunch, Goines, just a few family names like that. And of course, as more and more people have joined the family, so to speak, the list of names has grown, but there are those kind of core family names that are markers of Melungeon ancestry in this area. If you were in Boston, the name Collins almost certainly means you're of Irish ancestry, but in northeast Tennessee, Collins can mean Melungeon.
So you mentioned that they had a darker complexion and so on. What did they look more like? I mean, did they have a very distinct, distinguishable, immediately identifiable look to them, or did they range all over the place as far as look, other than the darker complexion?
Well, in my book, I purposely juxtaposed several different and conflicting descriptions of physical appearance. One said they didn't look anything like African Americans. The next one said they looked just like African Americans. Some said they were tall and rarely fat, and another description said they were short and heavy set. So I guess it just depends on who you meet. But the description has generally been that they had features that were indicative of African or Native American ancestry quite often. And, of course, mixed with European. So you get all the different combinations that you can imagine from that sort of a mixture.
So dark hair and dark eyes.
Pretty common. With the Melungeons, it's been very common that they would have very dark features, but blue eyes. So.
Oh, really?
There's, interesting little things like that, little genetic legacies that we've had handed down from various ancestors.
Yeah, so that brings us to the theories of their origins, which have been in the past quite numerous and conflicting, and many of them very persuasive and compelling, and yet they're kind of competing theories. And the latest study that I mentioned at the outset has kind of punctured a lot of those, and we'll talk about that when we get to that point. But to kind of recap, what were some of the original long-running theories of their origin?
The theories have included that they were descended from Portuguese sailors or pirates. There has also been speculation they may have been deserters or stragglers from De Soto's expeditions when Hernando De Soto was exploring what is now the southeastern United States. One of the lost tribes of Israel has been mentioned as a possible
Atlantis source. Aliens.
Yeah. My cousin had the Martian theory based just on our own family, but I think a lot of the theories were presented as a defense mechanism to avoid discrimination and the consequences that would go along with an African ancestry in this country. So Portuguese was one that was very common. It was a way of explaining dark features, but still being a European Christian and therefore a good standing member of the society. Most of the scientific research has gone on the assumption that they are a triracial mixture of African, Native American, and European ancestry.
Okay.
But the theories make for good magazine and newspaper articles, or at least have for the last 100 or so years.
Yeah. Well, there was one theory that you talked about in your book, and I've seen elsewhere too, that they descended from, or at least some component of them, descended from Turkish slaves who were captured from a certain village in Turkey in a raid. And what's the name of the village is like Melankan or something. I mean, there's something very similar to the word Melungeon associated with it. And that's...
Well, yeah, in Turkish and in Arabic, the term Melungeon means cursed soul or one who has been abandoned by God.
Oh,
and
okay.
So that was to describe people who had been taken from their home and abandoned in a strange land. Again, makes a very good story, but... we haven't really seen any scientific evidence. The idea that there were Turks who were left on Roanoke Island at the time of the lost colony, actually just before the colony that was lost, has been pretty much discredited, although it has shown up in several historical books, basically speculating that Sir Francis Drake had dropped these people off. But actually... There is record that he did have these captives that he had captured in South America, taken them from the Spanish, but they were valuable to the Sultan, so he ransomed them back. And of anybody he might have left on Roanoke Island, these weren't the people because they were actually worth money to bring them back.
It would have been more like mutinous sailors or something you might have dropped
right.
off, since swim or get out or whatever, but... Well, the word thing, the etymology of it or whatever, is also interesting. I think there's an old English word, malingen, which means an evil doer, right? And then there's the French word, malingion, which means someone who's a mixture.
Mm-hmm.
So it's so odd that these words from different languages all very plausibly could point to being the origin of that word, so that kind of confuses or kept the theories going,
It's a word that is mysterious, and oddly enough, I have seen some newspaper articles from the period immediately before and immediately after the Civil War where Melungeon was used as a sort of a derogatory political term. And it was in newspapers, which would indicate that it was a generally understood what that word meant, but the meaning of it has since been lost. It's very intriguing to see it used in newspapers in the mid-19th century with the understanding that people would know what that word meant, but today people have no idea.
Back at that time, then, in that context, was it used to mean like an independent, somebody who was of neither party or who had voted both ways?
It was always used in a derogatory manner for one's political opponents. It was it was one thing that in the Tennessee legislature they would say someone is as tricky as a Melungeon or as sneaky as a Melungeon. It always had a negative connotation.
So it's kind of like the idea of gypsy in Europe.
Very much so.
Okay, so somebody who was kind of outside and who wasn't trusted and you didn't really know where they came from, except you knew they weren't from where you are or something
right.
like that.
They're not us.
Yeah, okay, that's it. You're listening to American Variety Radio with your host, Court Lewis, and we hope you are us and enjoying the show. I'm here with Wayne Winkler, who's an historian. We're talking about the Melungeons, a distinct demographic group in northeast Tennessee and southwest Virginia and that region of the Cumberland Gap in the kind of far northwestern part of the Smokies, maybe. I'm not sure what exactly the mountains are, but anyway, in that area. And some recent revelations or studies that have shed more light on where they might have come from. What did they think they were at the time? I mean, I think that they said primarily that they were of Portuguese descent a lot, but what is there any indication of what they really thought they were, or did they all believe that?
Basically, the story had been handed down that they were of Portuguese ancestry, but in many families, the Indian ancestry was more prominent. In my own family, my father always referred to his family as being Indian. And one time I asked him, you know, why did you say Indian rather than Melungeon? He said, because people know what an Indian is. I don't have all day to explain what a Melungeon is. So I think that there has been pretty much the assumption among Melungeons as well as the more scientific researchers as opposed to feature writers that the Melungeons were a triracial mix. And, you know, in the days of segregation and discrimination, the African component was naturally kind of downplayed. If, you know, if there was any doubt in the mind of someone asking questions, it was, well, we're Portuguese or we're Indian or a combination of those. But I think the African component has always been more or less taken for granted as part of the mixture.
Well, I think, you know, it's unfortunate, but it's true to say that back in those days, the African Americans were at the bottom of the social pecking order, and, you know, Hispanics, Native Americans, and other non-white, non-Western European racial derivations, however you say that, were somewhere in between. So I guess it was better to be anything but considered African American, and it wasn't just purely social reasons, but there were legal reasons for that too, right? So why don't we spend a minute talking about that?
As recently as the 20th century, in Virginia, they had the Racial Integrity Act of 1924, which basically divided the state into white and colored, and so there was no category for Indians, there was no category for anything other than pure white, and then there was everyone else. So that discrimination has only disappeared to the extent that it has disappeared, you know, very recently.
For example, I read somewhere that if a woman, a wife, if her husband died, a black couple, an African-American couple, if the and they were free people and owned property, if the husband died, I think the woman was not able to inherit his property. Is that right?
There were different laws that that had an effect. There was one major case where there was an inheritance involved. A young woman stood to gain her father's estate, but his father had married a Melungeon. And so the question was the Melungeon woman African-American, in which case the marriage was not legal and the daughter was entitled to nothing. And so that was one in which kind of a Portuguese or ancient Carthaginian ancestry was proposed. And the case worked. I mean,
had a good lawyer.
Yeah. I mean, a good lawyer can sell any kind of an idea.
Yeah.
But in terms of there have been researchers who have said, well, this is proof. And I always say, well, it doesn't really prove anything. Courts can rule on anything. There was a court that ruled O.J. didn't do it. So you can always find a court ruling to support just about any position, but that doesn't necessarily make it a historical fact.
Sure. I mean, in that case, the judge could have been sympathetic to the woman and just said, I find this way, you shut up. You know, so whatever. But I think there were lawsuits back then. If somebody would be, in a way, accused of being a Melungeon, the defendant or the plaintiff would sue the accuser because, in effect, if that title stuck, they would lose rights in the community and standing in the community, business-wise and legally and everything
else. They would. As I told the Associated Press recently, that sometimes it's a little embarrassing to look at the extent that our ancestors went to deny African ancestry, but there were consequences involved, and it was really a matter of survival. I won't say there wasn't racism among the Melungeons, but that wasn't the main motivating factor to deny African ancestry. There were very real and severe consequences.
So I mentioned the recent DNA study. Who conducted that?
That was begun by a gentleman named Jack Goines in Rogersville, Tennessee, who's been researching Melungeons genealogically and historically for a number of years. And he wanted to answer these questions. And there had been DNA studies done before, but they were based on modern-day people who claimed Melungeon ancestry. They were self-identified, and there was no way of verifying, you know, that they actually did have Melungeon ancestry. So the results you would get were not necessarily accurate in terms of who the Melungeons were historically. So Jack Goines, along with Penny Ferguson, Janet Crane, and Roberta Estes, began a DNA study based on people who had been identified as Melungeons in historical records, going back to the 1830 census of Hawkins County, where there were over 400 people listed in that county as free persons of color. They were looking at people who had been named in court cases historically. Basically, they were trying to identify people who were identified as Melungeon 150 or more years ago. Then they were looking for primarily male descendants in an unbroken male line from these individuals. So let's say you have John Collins identified in the 1830 census as a free person of color. You would look for someone who, like John Collins, had a son who had a son who had a son and so on, an unbroken male line to the present day, so they could test the Y chromosome, which is exclusively in males. And they did mitochondrial DNA, a much smaller study, which involves female lines. But it was a very restrictive study on purpose. They were trying to find the DNA that people in the early 19th century had and see that passed down in an unbroken line. So that was kind of to start a baseline. Nobody was saying these are the only Melungeons. You know, if you don't connect up with these folks, you're not a Melungeon. That wasn't the intent at all. They just wanted to get a baseline of people who were known Melungeons and see what they found. And the results were somewhat surprising, because they did not find any Native American DNA in the male lines of the people who had been tested. What they found was either African or European. Now there's
either or both.
Well, no, it was either or.
Okay.
So that leaves open a lot of questions, which the study was not able to address, because the study was published in the Journal of Genetic Genealogy, and being a genetic study, they were able to present the data. This is what we found, and there was no speculation or analysis provided with that. I mean, a bit, but they weren't able to say, well, here's what might have happened. Here's how this might be explained. That's kind of left for people to start working on now, historians and anthropologists, people who are outside the strict biological sciences. So when the Associated Press story came out, a lot of people got the impression that, okay, there's no Portuguese, there's no Native American, there's nothing. It's a simple mixture of black and white.
The story is now black and white.
Yeah, and that's not exactly the way it is. Any of these subjects, going back to our hypothetical John Collins from the early 19th century, may have had a Native American mother or a Native American grandmother, and that would not have shown up on the DNA.
Oh, I see.
But one thing that was shown that there are people who have speculated that the African ancestry in the Melungeons might have gone back to the Moorish occupation of Spain and Portugal, or even earlier, because if you look at things like the National Geographic Human Genome Project, it kind of indicates that the human race began in Africa, so everyone has some sort of an African gene. But the haplogroup, the specific genetic groupings that show where people originated, for the Melungeons was E1B1A, which this is over my head. I barely got through
high school
biology, but
yeah.
But I just recently checked again and made sure I understood this from Roberta Estes, who is a genetic analyst, and she pointed out that this is a particular mutation of the gene that is associated with African Americans, rather than you could find a variant of that gene in Europe, all over Europe. There are ostensibly white Europeans who have the African gene E1B1B, and that is a much older type of African gene. The E1B1A is much more modern. It dates from about the period of the slave trade, and it is very, very common among African Americans. So what that suggests is that the ethnic mixture took place in colonial America rather than centuries before.
Okay, so then if I follow all that, there's an implication that the original Melungeons were more likely a mixture of a black male and a white female, is that the idea? Or at least a black and white person and not Native Americans, and that admixture took place in colonial America rather than in the ports of Africa or something like that.
Right.
I think I did see that some other scientists not involved in this study have speculated that, I mean, go ahead and explain like where that origin would have occurred.
Well, again, we are only looking at the data that came out without any kind of analysis. But historically, it would seem that we're talking about the free African American population of colonial America, because you know many of the people who were enslaved originally were not enslaved for life; they were enslaved for a period of 7 years. It was indentured servitude, much the same way many European families got to America.
Yeah, Irish, for example.
Right. So it was the same for many of the first slaves that came, for example, the slaves in Jamestown. They were all indentured and were freed after a seven-year period. So these are people who historians, myself included, speculate that they went further west into the frontier and joined up with some of the Indian groups that were in the process of dissolution. The smaller Indian groups were kind of decimated by disease and encroachment from larger Indian groups. So these free African Americans hooked up with Native American women and then later with European women, and those women with European men. And so that's really logically, that's kind of the way it worked. Genetically, we didn't see that, but it was because of the restricted nature of the study itself. I think what the study shows is not, it doesn't really answer a lot of questions. And like many studies, when you get a few answers and it generates twice as many new questions. But I think that what it does show us is that rather than looking for Spanish pirates or lost colonists or lost tribes of Israel or something like that, we would do better to look at the free African-American population of Virginia and the Carolinas in colonial era. And in doing that, we may find the Portuguese or other groups that have been part of the legend. But I think that it's certainly points to a mixture that took place in America rather than earlier and somewhere else.
So you mentioned, Wayne, that the result of the study was a surprise to you. What's been the reaction among the larger Melungeon community who are not historians but are just regular people? Have they been shocked by it? Is it still an emotionally charged issue to be associated with, you know, the African-American component more fully?
It is for some, but I would say that most people who have been interested in researching Melungeons in regards to their own family went into this research expecting to find some African ancestry, but they also expected to see Native American ancestry, and that didn't show up in this study. Most of the people who know about this know about it from the Associated Press article rather than reading the study itself, which is 100 pages long. The Associated Press story was just a few paragraphs, and it was very widely distributed.
And so, you were quoted in it, by the way.
Yes, I was.
15 minutes of fame right there.
There we go. But I think the Associated Press did a good job in explaining it as best they could. But I think what people missed was the idea that we now know something about who these Melungeons were, but it doesn't tell us the whole story. There are still many, many possibilities left open by that. The idea that a lot of people got from the story was that, okay, well, they've proved that all these stories were false, that it's a simple mixture of European and African ancestry, and that's not the case at all. That is what was shown, but it didn't rule out many, many other possibilities.
And also, as you explained before, it can be misinterpreted because, you know, if you follow just that Y chromosome line, you're seeing a particular tunnel through somebody's genetic makeup, but their whole genetic makeup can be, you know, again, the melting pot, quite complicated. And depending on where you are geographically, you're going to, especially in frontier times, you know, people were few and far between. And, so you're going to incorporate some of the gene pool of everybody around you over,
right,
over a period of a century or so. You know, there's generally that melting pot goes on, right? So,
right, it does. It does. And I think that as people take these genetic studies and apply historical research and sociological research, anthropological research, they're probably going to come up with a much more probable explanation. The thing with the Melungeons is that historians are pretty much bound to present what is probable rather than what is plausible. But with the Melungeons, we've had a lot of stories that come out that are plausible, but not exactly probable. And so the more information that we have along the lines of genetic studies and things like that, the more we come up with the probable rather than the plausible.
Well, you know, it's interesting. And everybody, you know, especially as they become an adult, is interested in their roots. And, you know, I think for any sensible person in 21st century America, everybody realizes we're all tribal in one way or another. I mean, I'm Celtic and Welsh and Scottish and, you know, and some of those things. And, you know, they were all once tribes running around in the woods shooting animals with bows and arrows, you know. And, you know, so everybody, I think, does a search for their roots. And so this study has given more information to people of the Melungeon descent about their roots. And, you know, I know you've been interested in it for a long time. And people who, you know, are interested in reading a little more about this story can go to the Melungeon Heritage Association's website, which is Melungeon, and I'm going to spell it melungeon.ning.com. So it's melungeon.ning.com. Wayne Winkler, I want to thank you for being on with us and shedding more light on this interesting subject of the Melungeons of Appalachia.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Nice to have you on. And thanks to you all for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.